Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
And where Canto 1, Chapter 13, verse, was it 16, I think?
Yes, 16.
16 to 28 or something along those lines. A lot of verses. We'll get well versed. Let's see. So, what I thought we would do, there's a whole set story here, and I thought we would go around and read the story, just the verses, and then I'll go through some of the purports. So we'll kind of give you a picture of what the story is here, because it's an interesting story. So we'll begin with 16. And who would like to begin? Would like, on the first two verses, just chant the Sanskrit, not responsively, because there's a lot to cover. And then the English. And then the rest, just the English. So who would like to begin? Sure, we can do the Sanskrit together. That's great. You start. Very good. Thank you. Good idea.
Yudhisthira lamyaya vacho visvapukram kulamdaram radavilloka palavayen mumude paraya shriya.
Having won his kingdom and observed the birth of one grandson competent to continue the noble tradition of his family, Maharaj Yudhisthira reigned peacefully and enjoyed uncommon opulence and cooperation with his younger brothers, who were all expert administrators to the common people.
Yeah, and we'll do the Sanskrit on the second verse in English, after that just the English.
Evam griheshu saktanam pramantanam tad ihaya atyakramad avignataha kala paramad.
Insurmountable, eternal time imperceptibly overcomes those who are too much attached to family affairs and are always engrossed in their thought.
Is there something wrong with that? Oh, never mind. Okay. We'll get to that later. Okay, now we're going to go on to verse 18, English only.
Mahatma Vidura knew all this, and therefore he addressed Dhritarashtra, saying, "My dear king, please get out of here immediately. Do not delay. Just see how fear has overtaken you."
And the next verse.
This frightful situation cannot be remedied by any person in this material world. My lord is the supreme personality of Godhead as eternal time, Kala, and has approached us all.
20.
Whoever is under the influence of supreme Kala, eternal time, must surrender his most dear life, and what to speak of other things such as wealth, honor, children, land, and home.
And your 20. Father, brother, well-wishers, and sons are all dead and passed away. You yourself have expended the major portion of your life. Your body is now overtaken by invalidity, and you are living in the home of another.
You have been blind from your very birth, and recently you have become hard of hearing. Your memory is shortened, and your intelligence is disturbed. Your teeth are loose, your liver is defective, and you are coughing up mucus.
Alas, how powerful are the hopes of a living being to continue his life. Verily, you are living just like a household dog and are eating remnants of food given by Bhima.
There is no need to live a degraded life and subsist on the charity of those whom you tried to kill by arson and poisoning. You also insulted one of their wives and usurped their kingdom and wealth.
Despite your unwillingness to die and your desire to live, even at the cost of honor and prestige, your miserly body will certainly dwindle and deteriorate like an old garment.
He is called undisturbed who goes to an unknown, remote place and, freed from all obligations, quits his material body when it has become useless.
He is certainly a first-class man who awakens and understands, either by himself or from others, the falsity and misery of this material world, and thus leaves home and depends fully on the personality of Godhead residing within the heart.
Please, therefore, leave for the north immediately, without letting your relatives know, for soon that time will approach which will diminish the good qualities of men.
Okay, and that takes us through the section today. This is not a great day for Dhritarashtra. He is not exactly, I mean, look at the scene. I mean, my gosh, it would be disresponsible for the killing of millions of people. Who has been to the battlefield of Kurukshetra? Who has been there? Okay. It looks like a battlefield. It kind of looks like a battlefield. And you get, I took a bus there a long time ago, and I got off. There's a big temple in the shape of a chariot with Krishna and Arjuna in it. I said, wow. And I had gone to India hoping to learn something about the Gita. And I was sent off just to test my Hindi skills for a weekend. So it's kind of like my training agency just basically just picked cities. So I picked a city called Thanesur. I had no idea Thanesur was the place where the Battle of Kurukshetra took place, because that's the name of the bus station. The name of the train station is Kurukshetra. So I got off in Thanesur, and there I am on the battlefield. I said, my God. This is a place that looks like a battlefield. And then I went over to the local university. And the local university, they have a University of Kurukshetra. I went to the student center. And in those days, it was, you never saw an American there. So I was a tourist attraction. So I was surrounded by students. So I turned to them and said, so this is that place in the Gita? I said, yes. I said, I've heard of these Hare Krishnas. Kind of odd, but is it real or not real? Is it made up or not made up? And they said, what do you think of Nixon? I said, I left America to get away from that. All this politics and you know, silliness and things go on. And at that time, the Vietnam War was on, and Nixon was bombing Cambodia, and the American embassy, a consulate, was located on Harrison Road. You know Harrison Road in Calcutta. And the government of Bengal, a communist government, very clever, they officially changed the name of Harrison Road in Calcutta to Ho Chi Minh Marg. Ho Chi Minh Road. So the American stationery had to say on there, American consulate, Ho Chi Minh Road. And of course, Ho Chi Minh was the enemy. He was leading the North Vietnam. That was very funny, I thought. I thought that was pretty funny. But I don't think the Americans thought it was nearly as funny. So I Kurukshetra, there, is there something? Wow, this could be a very spiritual place. It felt that way when I got there. I mean, it had that heavy feeling. But the students were interested in American politics. I said, this is weird. But anyway, it was a very heavy scene. Dhritarashtra, so many people killed, and he, of course, was materially and spiritually blind. Yet, not spiritually dead. Now, that's an important distinction, because we find that Krishna says, don't disturb the minds of the ignorant in the Gita. Now, my question to you is, if Krishna is saying, don't disturb the minds of the ignorant, who could be more ignorant than Dhritarashtra? Trying to kill his own, sanctioning, not that he did, sanctioning the killing of his own nephews, doing all these weird things. Who could be more? So why should Vidura, who is the junior, the kind of called a sudra by some? Who is Vidura really? Yamaraj, yeah. But anyway, he had the body of a sudra. We should be careful who we call sudras. We don't know who they really are. We should be careful who we call Brahmins. We don't know who they really are either. So, again, we know who someone is by their qualities, not their birth. And Vidura's qualities are very advanced. So my first question is, wasn't Vidura, who the Gita had already been spoken, Krishna had already said what to do about certain minds of ignorance. And here you have this old man, his little, you know, foaming at the mouth a little, probably wearing Depends by then. You know, the usual routines you have to do at that time, you know. His bodily functions not exactly under control. You wouldn't want him at the dinner table. And so here you have Dhritarashtra in this state, living as if he's still the king. And the palace is accepting him. Oh, your holiness, your royalness, your most worshipfulness, so good to see you this morning. How bright the sun is. Oops, I forgot you can't see it. Well, how bright it would be if you could see it. And so you have this, and being treated that way, why not just let the old man die in peace? Why? And he's so ignorant. So wasn't Vidura stepping out of line here? Can somebody help me out with this? Yeah.
Isn't the reason Krishna says not to disturb the minds of the ignorant is because then they won't be able to do their work? If they don't do their work, then there's a lot of trouble for them. Dhritarashtra was at a point where he didn't have any work. He was just kind of in this state. Yeah, he was just hanging out, and kind of in a fearful position. He really wasn't doing any work. So. Yeah. He should have had some work, and his work should have been spiritual realization.
Like that 40-year-old who still lives with his parents because he's too lazy to get a job. Something like that.
He should become Babaji.
Yeah. Or that 40-year-old should at least get a job. But yeah. Okay. I like that answer. Any other comments on this? Yes, Jitan.
Compassionate Vaishnava, that they actually do go in and preach and take the whatever reaction on their head so that the person can understand. So we do take that risk.
Okay. So your point is, well, we might take a risk. The question then becomes, when do we take the risk? When do we take it and when we don't? For example, I've been the experience where I would be approached, or maybe I'm a Harinam or something, and approached by a very pious, loving Christian who wants to really let me know that I am surely going to hell. In this place of hell, I will burn in eternal damnation, which is good length of time, you know, that will keep me busy for a while, and if I explain to them the huge philosophical contradiction they have, and I've attempted to do such things, one of two results will come. The usual result is they have a very easy solution. Ah, that was very clever what you said. Only the devil could produce such thoughts. That proves you're the devil. Well, that solves that problem. But it prevents me from creating the other problem that Krishna was also worried about in the Gita. And the other problem is if I really convince him, then they have a great danger of becoming an atheist entirely. At least now they accept some higher authority, no matter how crazy it sounds. At least there's some moral standard they accept. But then they become an atheist. So if you disturb mind to the ignorant, one problem is you take away all their faith. So it has to be done artfully. We take a chance when preaching, but it has to be done with some intelligence, some art. Yes, this is a good candidate to explain Krishna consciousness to. Dhritarashtra was a very good candidate. I mean, he really was. He accepted right away what was said. And he went north to the woods, and he went off into the Himalayas, and his very, very special wife followed him. And there, he did not even need a funeral pyre. Yudhisthira, when he heard he was gone, felt so bad. I better go chase him so we got to his funeral. And Narada Muni told him, no, his body will spontaneously burn to ashes. He's actually, I mean, here he is, a very advanced person who had kind of deviated. And so Vidura just very artfully but forcefully brought him back. So it's a real art. So sometimes we can approach somebody ignorant and we can actually ruin their life. I take away their faith, and sometimes we can save their life. So, no hard and fast rules, kind of an art here. But that's the first question that comes up. Now, we'll begin. I'm going to go back to verse 16, give a few things in the purport. Let's see. Well, this verse is an interesting one. I mean, most of you here are grahastas, will become grahastas, were grahastas, or will be, what's that?
Like grahastas.
You know something about grahastas. Now, insurmountable eternal time imperceptibly overcomes those who are too much attached to family affairs and are always engrossed in their thoughts. But such illusion, Prabhupada says, cannot work on one who is awake in the devotional service of the Lord. Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers, the Pandavas, were all engaged in the service of the Lord, and they had very little attraction for illusory happiness. So, this is a very fascinating verse. This verse has probably done more good and more harm in the Krishna movement than most other verses. It's been one of the best verses and the worst of verses, to paraphrase Dickens. The best of verses and the worst of verses. So how can this verse be the best of verses and the worst of verses? Who can help me with that?
Yeah. Inspire you to engage your family and your ideas about your family in the service of Krishna.
Yeah.
That's the good side of it. And the bad side of it is that you would neglect your family. That's never good, to neglect your family. Why? Because you have a responsibility.
Maya, come on, I drag you down. The kids make cute faces. The Bhagavan Sun says the cute little crying of a child. It captured the father or grandfather's heart, and you just listen to them. And they're so nice. And the wife, she serves so well, and she dresses to be pretty for you. It cooks and serves. Who's met that wife? But anyway, does all these things. But ideally speaking, it can be very illusory. It can give a lot of illusion. I'm the master of my house. Let me see, it's another verse that mentions this. It's a heavy scene. I mean, what do you do?
When you start a family, you have the responsibility to maintain the family and keep them happy. And the best way to keep them happy is to engage them in Krishna service.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but Prabhupada's family wasn't very surrendered, so he had a choice of a cup of tea or not, and he chose renounced life. Didn't he? Over a cup of tea? So what's going on here? There's a little more to this picture. His spiritual master ordered him to drink tea? No. No, his guru never ordered that. Oh, in the dream? Yeah. Well, he had a dream. He had a dream that, yeah, in that sense, yeah. He had a dream that he should do something more. Of course, Prabhupada's children were grown. It wasn't young children he was leaving. And even after Prabhupada became very famous and by some standards had all kinds of material resources, he immediately set up a pension for his ex-wife and helped his children out. Was visited them, gave them some money to start selling his books. Here, you have a business. It wasn't like he was cold-hearted about it, but he did have to renounce, but there was a certain period of time. The way this verse is harmful is anybody who is in family life will immediately learn two things. Immediately, after a short time, let's say. One is, it's really wonderful when you have a family, and especially you can do devotional service together. It's profoundly satisfying. And they'll also learn that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, and they're two entirely different species, and what the hell are they doing together? I mean, my wife's, a marriage and family therapist. This is what she deals with all day. It's true. I mean, in one sense, it's Krishna's challenge to see if it's very good for the male ego sometimes to be with a woman, because what was it? There's this wonderful play Pygmalion. In this play Pygmalion, it's written by George Bernard Shaw, who was a avid vegetarian, extremely avid vegetarian around 1900. And that play of the book eventually became a very famous Broadway play, one of the longest running Broadway plays ever, called My Fair Lady. And then it became a movie, My Fair Lady. And in it, there's one very funny song. The man who is sitting with his friend, he was the consummate bachelor. Older fellow, always wanted to be a bachelor, and he sings this song. Why can't a woman be more like a man? They're so peaceful, so nice. You remember that? Yeah. Why can't a woman be more like a man? And of course, there are similar songs sung by the women. And so we have this situation where we have, let's say take your brain apart, okay? Open the skull up and look inside and analyze it very carefully. And then we'll take Amrita Kelly's brain. We're going to open it up and analyze it. I would discover this fact. Now, I can't say 100% in yours, 100% in yours, but the overwhelming majority of men and overwhelming majority of women, your brain, the number of neural connections in left and right half far exceeds the number you have. Far exceeds. I mean, it's a neurologically observable fact. Now, what does that mean? It means men and women's brains tend to be more integrated as far as the rational and emotional sides of the brain. And men's tend to be less integrated, which is how it is. It's good. It's good because men will tend to do things more cognitively and women will tend to do things more intuitively. I mean, tend to. There's some exceptions to everything. Now, what's the advantage of doing something cognitively? Well, you think about it. You're rational. It's that rational analysis. What's the advantage of doing things intuitively? You get a lot more accomplished. It's usually better decisions. You have more brain cell, more nerve cells in your gut, or equal number of nerve cells in your gut as you do in your brain. You do. So when somebody says, it's my gut feel, it's not illusion. It's real. It's a very real phenomena. And so we try to integrate ourselves. For example, in devotional service, we think about a lot of things. I'll give you an example of something you want to do intuitively, but you don't want to think about. Really good example. And you do it every day. Chant japa. Now, if you're chanting japa and you're just really in the pace and the mood of japa, you and the holy name just become one. But if you're thinking about it, here's the problem. I'm thinking, oh, that last mantra wasn't so good. I was thinking about things. The next mantra will be right. Well, you just missed another mantra. You're not in the moment. You're thinking about it. I'm analyzing it. Should I do this mantra? And meanwhile, you're chanting, Hadi mumble, 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 Hadi mumble, 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 and mumble, mumble. And so you're thinking, that last mantra was a good next one. But, you know, that's not working very well. And we all have done that, I'm sure. I mean, who here has not done that? You haven't done it? I mean, we all do that. It's just natural. And it's controlling the mind. The reason we... Why is it we use fingers with the beads? One reason is, if you have three senses engaged, it controls your mind. That's why, I mean, with this horrible, horrible tragedy of our Tim passing away, and part of it was the driver had a cell phone. And when you drive with a cell phone and you hold it to your ear, what happens? If you're talking to the person in the car next to you, slight distraction, maybe an earpiece, slight distraction. But when you take your hand and you grab something and you hold it by your ear, it's a much greater distraction. This because of the principle of japa. When you're touching something, it's bringing, you know, here you have hearing, speaking, touch, three senses. Guess what it does? It's the secret of capturing your mind. That's why we have beads or clickers or whatever we have for japa. It's that sense of touch that makes such a huge difference. And when you hold a cell phone to your ear, I watch this student, I bicycle, you know, most places, I'm going on campus, and I've seen two phenomena with students. One is when they're drunk, especially in the evening. Like, I had a meeting downtown last Friday night. It wasn't late, it was 7, 8 o'clock. And so I'm going downtown, and some guy on the corner standing with a bullhorn with a shirt telling everyone they're going to hell, a Jesus freak. And then the students are there and they're drunk and they're walking this not straight line. Well, when I'm watching on campus 10 o'clock in the morning and they have the cell phone in the ear, they're walking the same line. Because on a bicycle, I can predict by the way people are walking if they're going to cut in front of me or not. But if they have a cell phone, I cannot predict that. They might cut right in front of me. And I have to bicycle differently, more defensively when people are on a cell phone. Anyway, it's a little digression, but it is an important message here. There's this huge danger that we put ourselves into all the time that way. We're getting, and this all was having a discussion because we're discussing the brain. So in the brain, we'd like to get our brain a little more integrated, because when the brain is integrated, things come natural. And that's why whatever we do, we practice. We'll pick on Chaitanya. Chaitanya, as you know, was the champion of sand volleyball in the country. She was one of the top players. Now, when you were playing volleyball, did you think about what you were doing? Yeah. But you knew intuitively what to do. And that's what Christian consciousness becomes like. And we're going to try to tie this into this verse in a moment, interesting way. Now, I'll tell you the secret of winning at ping pong, volleyball, racquetball, any game. Maybe I shared this with you before. But here is a secret studied very repeated test by psychologists. Here is how you're going to win. Somebody here play ping pong? Okay, here's how you win. What's that? No, this is better. No. This way, you will surely win. You're playing, right? And the other person hits a really good serve. And then this ball, you hit it back, it goes out of bounds, whatever happens. And you say to that person these magic words, "Wow, what a brilliant serve. How did you do that?" And as soon as they start thinking about how they did it, they can't do it again. It has to be intuitive. It doesn't work cognitively. Because it's so fast, just like a baseball player. It takes half a second to have a cognitive thought. It takes 3 to 4 tenths of a second for a ball to go from the pitcher to home plate. No way to think about it. So, let's tie that back into this verse. I hope. Insurmountable time overcomes those who are too attached to family affairs and are always engrossed in their thought. So, if we're really overly engrossed in our family affairs, it's a great danger. But the key word here is overly engrossed. Or too much, always engrossed. The key word here is to be simultaneously chinta beta beta tattva kind of truth, there and not there. I am outwardly very attached to my family, and inwardly I'm really thinking of Krishna. What devotees sometimes really get messed up is when they get this verse turned around and they become inwardly very attached to their family and outwardly very attached to Krishna. Very, very dangerous. Oh, my family is great Maya. They're horrible. But inwardly it's very attached. It's the reversal of this verse, the reversal of this concept that causes this verse to cause trouble. So, and the solution is very simple. The Krishna consciousness can't be artificial. It can't be this cognitive thing where I think I ought to be Krishna conscious. And when it's like, I think I ought to serve the ball well. You can't serve it well. It's, I think I ought to be Krishna conscious. Rather, it is, I am Krishna conscious. And then that comes natural. And then the cognitive thought is, okay, how can I keep my family happy? How can I do this? And how do you develop this natural Krishna consciousness? The same way Chaitanya developed she taught her natural volleyball skills. A lot of practice, which is why you're here and you're doing sadhana bhakti. Because if we develop it, we won't get this verse mixed up. And if we don't develop it, then our false ego would say, I want to appear to be a great devotee. I want to appear so wonderful. But so I'll appear very renounced, but inwardly I'm attached. No, outwardly. Bhakti Vinod Thakur told me, I'm very much into my family, but inwardly I know it's for Krishna. So it's a real art. We're going to move on because there's too much to cover here. Let me see. Of course, I marked it at home, not here, but there's another purport of some interest. So many things here. You can ask a question now.
Why were there sannyasis that took sannyas when they had little kids?
Why? Yes, that's forbidden now. In an emergency, sometimes you have to do the needful. For example, it was a curious thing. Haridai Nanaraj tells a fascinating little story. One time, he was a grihastha in Houston, and one of the big leading sannyasis showed up at the temple. And that was before cell phones and things, so internet, and so people just show up. Maybe they send a letter, but it might not get there. And so he was one of the senior sannyasis movement showed up. They were just about to make the offering. He went, took the Lord's plate away from the temple, Gornatai then, Rosalie Street. Not Rosalie, before Rosalie, Alabama Street. He took the plate away and handed it to the sannyas and said, "We just made lunch for you. Here it is." Instead of offering to the Lord. Now, that seems like a radical move. The purport in which Prabhupada said to do that had not yet been published. Later that came out. So intuitively, he did the right thing. So that's like an emergency. What do you do? So in an emergency, you do different things. When Prabhupada was here, there was everyone in the movement Gopal would have been 20 years beyond the most senior member of the movement. And Gopal looks like he's 15. So you can just see. So in that time, Prabhupada needed sannyasis. He needed everything. I mean, who is qualified to be a temple president with very little training? So Prabhupada just gave people, knowing they would rise to the occasion, and knowing some wouldn't, but at least establish what it looks like. And the very first sannyasi who couldn't make it and got married, people forget this, Prabhupada performed the ceremony. You can see it on Yarabhatta's film. Prabhupada actually performed the wedding. He wasn't disturbed. Better to have sannyasi'd and lost than never sannyasi'd at all. It was very difficult. It was an emergency time. And he expected us as a society to sort of fill in and help out. And in an emergency, sometimes you just do odd things. Let's say there's a war going on. You might do the most horrible thing of feed your soldiers, not your children. As sad as that is, because you don't feed the soldiers, all the children might die. They'll be killed. So sometimes in a time of a war, a time of emergency, things that happen that don't go ordinary. The GBC, of course, it forbids that now. It has forbid it for a decade. But Prabhupada expected it as a whole family for us to sort of fill in and help out. And remember, most devotees lived in ashrams and not outside. But it was an awkward system. Yeah, it was kind of emergency. And there weren't that many sannyasis who had children who took sannyas. And of those that took it, there weren't that many that made it. And those that made it, actually later on, usually would be responsible in some way to help the children out. And it's not forbidden for a sannyas to take care of their children. But, I mean, every society needs monks, renounced monks. And if we waited till 20 years after Prabhupada left to do that, then we would have done it in the style of someone else, not the style of Prabhupada. So he had to train people while he's here how to do it. Believe me, it was very awkward for Prabhupada. Sometimes when he gave sannyas, he would cry. Actually cry, tears would come, because he knew this is just too difficult. He wasn't what he wanted to do. It's what he had to do. Yeah, it's a good question, though. Yeah. That was also the best of times and the worst of times. So, Any other question? We'll continue. Yes.
I was curious about Vidura. They always call him a Shudra.
Yeah.
Shudra background. What about his father being Vyasadeva? Like, is that not, is it not half and half, or is it just like the mother's?
The question you're asking, does a woman have, does a woman even have a varna? I mean, some would contend women don't have varnas, whatever their husband has. I was discussing this recently with Haridai Nanda Maharaj. Does a woman have a varna? Yes, and there are many, many examples of it. So a woman can have their own varna. It's not that first thing is varna is by guna and karma, not by janma, not by birth. But even if it was by birth, a Brahmin marries a Kshatriya, and a Brahmin is qualified as a Brahmin. So by birth and guna and karma, she's a Brahmin, and then all of a sudden she marries a Kshatriya or Vaishya or Sudra, now she's a Sudra. That is an incorrect interpretation of it. And some people would call Vidura a Sudra in a teasing way, which was kind of affectionate, you know, just joking around. But his cousins weren't joking. They were very, very insulting to him, such that he became renounced and took off on his own. So, it's just like we have examples of, let's say, in America, people are different races. So it's very common in America for people to taunt someone from a different race. In America, that's been most notable with black people. And, I mean, you know the experience. People just treat, you know, in the South, in a place like Gainesville, if you were a black person born a black body in mid-60s, you could not drink from the same water fountain in Gainesville that I could drink. If you went to Wise Drugstore, there were two different water fountains. There are two different bathrooms in Gainesville. The last state university in the South to integrate, to allow blacks, was University of Florida. The last. There's a sign right over there on University Avenue. You can read it yourself. I don't know if you knew that. The very last. It wasn't Alabama. It wasn't Mississippi. It was Gainesville. The capital for the Ku Klux Klan was in Stark, and the most active chapter was La Crosse, where Kala Kant used to be a city commissioner. So, yes.
Well, Duryodhana calls Vidura a son of Sudrani. He didn't really call him Sudra.
Well, it's a similar kind of insult. Like children would do that. Let's say in India, there's one profession in which they dive into the septic tanks outside of, let's say, Krishna Balaram, and they clean out all the stool in the tanks. And there's a caste of people that's what they do. One time they fired them from their job and hired another company to do it. And they had protests, and they were going to fast till death if they didn't get a chance to dive back into the stool. So that's what they did. And the people that do that, so let's say you're their child, and I say, you son of a crap swimmer. You know? I mean, you would see the insult, right? But these people, that's what they do for a living, and their whole body is resistant to typhoid and tetanus, other things. They're cool about it. That's what they do. But if I called you the son of a stool swimmer, I mean, what are you going to think? You know, it's insulting. It's insulting your father and your mother. So it's kind of an insult. I mean, indirectly, they might not call him that, but it's pretty. It's like kids call each other these names. But so it's very insulting to identify someone by their body. And to identify, Prabhupada said number one disease, of course, is skin disease. So to point out someone's body and identify that body as the essence. Let's say I do this. I say to you, you said something nasty to me. You called me the you said, you know, your mother wears combat boots. Okay? Now, I can respond to you in one of two ways. One, I can say, you're an absolute jerk. Now, I've taken you and characterized you as a jerk. Or, I can say, boy, when you say that, it really makes me feel bad, or it makes me feel angry, or it makes me feel sad. You see the difference. Big difference. So one is I'm characterizing who you are. Really gets to the core of you. The other is I'm saying what effect that has on me. So that's an important, you know, it's like a psychological tool. But so somebody calls someone a son of a Sudrani or something, it can be an insult. And Vidura didn't respond back, son of a Sudra. Well, you're a son of you're an SOB. How's that? You know, get even worse. And no, he just said, I'm really hurt and sad by this, and took off. Yeah.
Sometimes he's also being called Dasi Putra, like the son of a maid servant.
Yeah, same thing. And it's characterizing him by his birth. It's just like was like to be Afro-American in Gainesville in 1965 to your birth. And what do people call you? If you might be a grown man, you might be a teacher at a school, and if you walked downtown and you were blocking the sidewalk, someone would say, boy, move it, boy. I mean, you're a grown man. You have children, grandchildren, you're a teacher, principal of the black school, not the white school. And people might say, hey, boy, move it. Pretty nasty stuff. Painful. And it's philosophically defective because it's assuming that one's birth determines one's varna and one's ashram. It's a spiritual defect. Every culture has it. India has it. America has it. Every culture has a spiritual defect. It's not just, oh, the caste system in India. I have not been any place in the world, and I've been many places in the world, that doesn't have this. So, we just got a few more minutes. There was one purport here that I was going to share you some more details on, but I didn't mark it. So is there another question? Yes.
I'm just confused why Sudra is a negative thing when I thought all parts of society were respected in their individual roles.
Yes, Sudra is not a negative thing. It's not, but... In an elitist society, people will elevate themselves by putting someone else down, and so in that society, because it wasn't very spiritually advanced. See, when Krishna appeared in the Gita, sometimes devotees look at Mahabharata, read Mahabharata, and say, "Well, I want to learn what Vedic culture is." You got it wrong. Krishna says in the Gita, the culture was destroyed, and I've come to reestablish it. So when you read Mahabharata, you're reading the destroyed culture that Krishna has to reestablish. You're not reading Vedic culture. You're reading remnants of it. You got to separate out. You got to separate the facts and the fiction. And believe me, the fiction is more than the facts. So in a real society, the sudras are given the same respect, the same empowerment and recognition as Brahmins or Kshatriyas. We all want empowerment and recognition. They're empowered to do the things, they're respected, but because of their nature and their upbringing and what they like, they don't have to do all the things that Brahmins do. They want to sleep in a little, that's cool. They got to be a little humble about it then. And if the Brahmins want to sleep in, that's not so cool. They have to do their ablutions in the morning. So, you know, different natures. I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right. But the society was already fallen. So when the society's fallen, we'll say things like, oh, you're a black man. You're a sudra. You're this, you're this, you're that. Yeah, it's like children calling each other names. You're exactly right. No, but and in Kali Yuga, everyone is Sudra. Everyone. Who here is really Brahmin? So we're all starting off very equal. It's very, very egalitarian. And then we try to rise up. But if we rise up and we become proud of what we do, that pride comes before the fall, and that's the challenge we have. It's the pride that kills the Brahmins. Look at Sringi, how proud he was. My father's a Brahmin. I can go curse Brikshit. I can do this. It's the pride comes before the fall is the first lesson we learn in the Bhagavatam. And many more after that, that is repeated. Okay, I think we're at the end here. Any last question while they're getting ready to serve out? Okay, we'll stop. Yeah. Well, let's do the prayer. Was there one last question? No. Oh, comment, sure.
I read somewhere, it wasn't in the Iskcon book, I forget what it was, but the chanting is both sides of your brain.
Ah, that's a good point. Chanting will. Because, chanting will integrate the brain. And when men and women get along well with each other, that also integrates the brain. And that's one of our challenges. We are believers in Radha and Krishna, the male and female aspect of God. With that, we will stop and eat. Haribol.